afternoon, all. Those of have impressed person, those who are here virtually. So we're going to be looking this week at Parashat Korach, obviously, which in the Art Scroll Chumash is starting on page 820. We're going to look at some of the Pesukim inside, share some ideas outside. Of course, Korach is every rabbi's favorite sefer. They tell the story about the rabbi who's only got one decent drasha. And it's on Parashat Korach. So whenever he goes to a shul as a visiting rabbi, he always wants to give his best drasha. But if it's Parashat Mishpatim or Parashat Vayeshev, he's stuck because how can he speak about Korach? So he goes into the pulpit and he says, I was going to speak about this week's Parashat of Mishpatim, but on the way to shul this morning, I noticed a hole in the road. And that reminded me of Korach. Now, Korach was a very wicked man, and he gives his Korach drasha there. So even if you don't come out with any good Dvarei Torah, you come out with a good joke to tell over the Friday night dinner table when the rest of the family say, do you have a Dvar Torah? You can say, I don't have a Dvar Torah, but I have a good joke on the parsha. Let's start at the very beginning, Pasuk Aleph. Vayikach Korach ben Yitzhar ben Kahat ben Levi. Korach, the son of Yitzhar, the son of Kahat, the son of Levi, took V'datan v'Aviram b'nei Eliav, and Datan and Aviram, the sons of Eliav, on ben Pelet b'nei Ruvain, and on the son of Pelet b'nei Ruvain, the sons of or members of the Reuvenite family. So Rashi flags up at the very beginning the challenge we've got in this pasuk, because grammatically it doesn't make sense. The syntax is, I don't want to say it's wrong, because this is Chumash. The syntax is problematic. It's difficult for us to understand. It says, Vayikach Korach, Korach took, but then it doesn't tell us what it was that Korach took. So let's look at Rashi, just the first couple of lines in Rashi. Rashi says as follows, Vayikach Korach, so Parashazu Yafan Nidreshet, B'Midrash Rabbi Tanchuma. So Rashi says, I'm going to give you the interpretations that appear in the Midrash Tanchuma. He's just telling us that he's sharing Midrashic interpretations with us. I saw a very nice vort on this. I'm sure it's not the Pshat at all, but as a Chassidish vort, this is Parashat Korach. Korach was a person who was committed to the downfall of Moshe and Aaron. He wanted to cause chaos in Am Yisrael. And nevertheless, how does Rashi start? Parashazu yafa nidreshet. We can darshan this parasha, even this parasha, we can darshan in a nice way. It's even somebody who seems terrible, like Korach, in actual fact, we can say some nice things about him. I don't think that's really what Rashi was saying, but it's a nice vort on Rashi. So vayikach Korach, what does it mean Korach took? Lakach et atzmo letzad echad. So Rashi's interpretation is that Korach took himself to one side. Liot nechlak mitoch haida, to separate himself from everybody else. Lo arer ala kuhuna, to object to the kuhuna. Mezoshet who came unkulus, and that's why the Aramaic translation, the first word there in the Targum unkulus, is v'it paleg Korach. Korach, plag, means to divide something into two. So Korach separated himself. So it's not that it's a verb just standing by himself, vayikach Korach, and doesn't tell us what it took. It's really vayikach Korach. Korach took himself off to one side and separated himself from everybody else. That's the way that Rashi interprets it. In actual fact, if we were to look at the Sforno says that you have to look at it in context with the next pasuk. If we read it together with the next pasuk, pasuk Bet, Vayakumu lifnei Moshe v'anashim ibnei Yisrael chamishim u'matayim, they stood in front of Moshe and 250 men from Bnei Yisrael. What it really means is Vayikach Korach. Korach took chamishim u'matayim nesi Yisrael. He took 250 men from B'nai Israel, or 250 Nasi'ei Eta, 250 leaders. That's what Korach took. So really what the Sforno is saying is that it's not difficult grammatically. There's a bit of sort of stuff thrown in the way. The sentence is constructed in a slightly convoluted way, but really, it, you know, it does make sense, even without any midrashic interpretation. Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch makes an interesting observation on the pasuk, and he says, "Vayikach Korach." What does it mean? Korach took himself, as Rashi says. You know, he took himself. What does it mean that he took himself? He assumed that he had a right to argue with Moshe Rabbeinu. Vayikach Korach, it was all about what he could take, what Korach could get. And this is the background to the whole story. The whole story is a story of Korach's self-interest. Korach tries to present it as, you know, I'm really interested in everybody. I'm not doing this for myself. I'm doing it for the benefit of the Israelite society. But in actual fact, that's not true. And his true motivations are unmasked or revealed with that very first word, Vayikach. It's all about what he could take. Korach was a taker. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Ferber, in his Sefer Kerem HaTzvi, he points out that in rabbinic tradition, that is the Gemara in Masechet Kiddushin, at the beginning of Masechet Kiddushin, the term kicha, to take, can also mean to buy. We talk about kikach ishisha, when a man marries a woman, and one of the ways that a man marries a woman is kinyan kesef, by giving a money or an item of value to the woman, and that way she becomes acquired to him. So he says, based on this, vayikach Korach, what does it mean Korach took? It means Korach bought his followers. He bribed Dathan and Aviram and all the people who were with him, because what was really in it for Dathan and Aviram? And this is one of the midrashic discussions about the whole thing. You know, what was going on here in terms of, you know, this is what On Ben Pelet's wife said to him. You know, if Moshe and Aaron are in charge, then Moshe and Aaron in charge. If Korach's in charge, then Korach's in charge. You're never going to be the leader yourself. You know, so there wasn't really anything in it for Dathan and Aviram. They didn't like Moshe. You know, if there's a change of leadership, they wouldn't like Korach either. So how did Korach get them onto side? Vayikach Korach. Korach took them by bribing them. He bribed them. He paid them. So that's the interpretation there of Rav Tzvi Hirsch Ferber. So that's the, if you like, the introductory remarks there on that phrase, Vayikach Korach. Rashi relates to the fact that it says, Ben Yitzhar, Ben Kahat, Ben Levi. So we've got, you know, we go back quite a long way. We're told who Korach, we're told about Korach, first generation, second generation, his father, third generation, his grandfather, fourth generation, his great-grandfather. Rashi discusses why we're not told about his great-great-grandfather, that he was a descendant of Yaakov. An idea that occurred to me, that why are we given such detailed lineage about Korach right at the very beginning of the parasha? Maybe because this is one of the things that was motivating Korach at the outset, in terms of why did Korach think that he should be allowed to assume a position of prominence. Korach was coming along and saying, look who I am. You might think that I'm a nobody, but do you know who my father was? Do you know who my grandfather was? Do you know who my great-grandfather was? My great-grandfather was Levi. You know, that's, I'm really choshev. And that's what gave Korach this sense of legitimacy. It's interesting because the Medrash actually flips it the other way around. The Medrash says Korach had a prophetic insight that he was going to be an ancestor of Shmuel Hanavi and that his descendants would be very important. So he was saying, you know, look who my descendants are, you know, I'm Shamus to the Pope. as it were. You know, my descendants are very important. I might not be so, but because of my descendants. But I think even in the psukim, we can see a pshat that he was saying, you know, my ancestors are very important. And this is something that we, you know, sometimes encounter. You know, people who come to us and, you know, they say, oh, you know, I should be allowed to do well because do you know who I am? They're not really saying, do you know who I am? It's not who I am. It's, do you know who my parents were? When I was one of my first position, I was teaching in the cheder in Watford when I was the rabbi there, and I wrote a bad report at the end of the year for one of the students, and I got a letter from the father, you know, saying, "Do you know that I was once invited to a reception to do with Soviet Jewry at Rabbi Jakobovitz's house?" You know, it's like, how can you criticize my son, you know, for his behavior in Cheder, you know, when I was invited to, you know, to that reception at Hamilton Terrace. Yeah, it had nothing to do with anything. This also has nothing to do with Korach. It wasn't defining who he was, but Korach thought that it was defining who he was. And that was his mistake. If we look at Pasuk Gimel tells us, Vayikalu al Moshe v'al Aharon, they congregated against Moshe and Aharon, Vayomru alehem, and they said to them, Rav lachem, you've taken too much importance for yourselves, ki chol ha'itah kulam kadoshim, because in actual fact, everybody is kadosh, everybody is holy, uvtocham Adonai, and Hashem is amongst everybody, and why are you promoting yourselves? Why are you, the Archgod here translating, why do you exalt yourselves over the congregation of Hashem? Why are you essentially, Karak saying, why are you being so arrogant? The Kotzker Rebbe said that, you know, this really tells us who Korach was. Because 2 weeks ago, at the end of Parashat Bahalotcha, what are we told about Moshe Rabbeinu? We're told, Va'esh Moshe anav mo'od mikol ha'adam, that Moshe Rabbeinu was more humble than anybody else in the world. Now Korach is coming, and that's what, you know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said in Parashat Bahalotcha. This is telling us how wrong Korach was. Just in case we thought that perhaps Korach, there was some legitimacy to what Korach was saying. In actual fact, this is demonstrating for us there was no legitimacy to it whatsoever. He was totally mistaken. He was accusing them of being arrogant when the Torah has told us previously that Moshe Rabbeinu was anything but arrogant. So, as we know, Korach and his merry band of followers leveled accusations against Moshe Rabbeinu and wanted to instigate some sort of revolt. Now, we might have thought that Moshe Rabbeinu would, if Moshe Rabbeinu really was the despot and the dictator that they're suggesting, then history has taught us that despots and dictators, what do? They shoot opponents. You know, throw them all into jail or shoot them, you know, make them disappear, something like that. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't do that. We might have thought Moshe Rabbeinu's situation was secure, so maybe he would ignore them. But that's not the case. Look at Pasuk Yud Bet. If you turn the page to Pasuk Yud Bet, just before the end of Rishon, what does the Pasuk say to us? Vayishlach Moshe nikro l'datan v'la'aviram b'nei Eliav. So Moshe sent to call to Datan and Aviram, the sons of Eliav. Vayomru lo na'ale. They said, no, we're not interested in talking to you. But we see that Moshe Rabbeinu was willing to engage with them. He reached out to them. And if you look at Rashi there on the Pasuk, sort of about a third of the way up on the left-hand column there in the Rashi, Pasuk Yud Bet, Rashi says, Vayishlach Moshe, Mikan she'en machazikim b'machloket. This teaches us that you don't grab onto a machloket. You try not to hold on to machloket. Shayam or Moshe machazer acharehem, nashlimam b'divrei shavon. Moshe, you know, chased after them to try and see if he could resolve the issue. We might have thought that Moshe Rabbeinu would have just, you know, ignored them or fought against them. But instead we see that he reached out to them. So I saw in the Sefer Mikdash Halevi, Sefer Mikdash Halevi is Divrei Torah of Rav Dunna, Rav Yosef Tzvi Dunna, J.H. Dunna, he was the Rav of the Adas Yisrael in Stamford Hill for many years. They put together some of his Divrei Torah there. And he says, isn't it obvious to us that in Machazikim B'machloket, that one shouldn't... grasp onto a machloket, that one should try and, avoid it. Would we have really expected anything different from Moshe Rabbeinu? And he says, yes, the answer is we might have expected different, because who was he dealing with? He was dealing with Datan V'Aviram. You know, we're not talking about, you have a machloket in somebody, in shul, because, one Shabbat they brought their grandchildren child to shul, and the grandchild was making a lot of noise during the laning, and you got annoyed with them, and, for 2 years, you had a bit of an, argy-bargy with them, and, eventually you got to make it up with them. In that case, forget it, fine, his grandson made a noise in shul, that's not the end of the world. But here we're talking about Datan V'Aviram, Moshe Rabbeinu had a history with them. According to Chazal, they were the ones who'd reported on Moshe Rabbeinu to Paro in Mitzrayim when he killed the Egyptian taskmaster. They were perhaps the ones who'd left over from the man. They were trying to test Moshe Rabbeinu. They were troublemakers. Nevertheless, we see that Moshe Rabbeinu tried to reach out to them. He didn't say, we're never going to get anywhere. And, this is a very sobering message, because, I don't want to speak for you, but I can only speak for myself. I've had, cases, you have machloket with people, you have arguments with people in shul. There are certain people, there's no point trying to resolve this. We've had so many arguments about so many things. The next time, I'm just not going to get involved with it. Let them say what they want, let them be miserable about me, let them grumble. We're not going to get this resolved. That wasn't the attitude of Moshe Rabbeinu. Even with wicked evildoers like Datan V'Aviram, Moshe Rabbeinu tried to resolve things. And I think that's a very, very important lesson. Indeed, there are many, many important lessons in Parashat Korach. So, I started off with the joke about the hole in the ground. And we know, of course, that that's exactly what happened to Korach and his followers. They were swallowed up by the hole in the ground. We find, if we look towards the end of the first perek here, Pasuk Lamed on page 826, what does Pasuk Lamed say to us? So, Moshe Rabbeinu has said, if I'm right, something amazing is going to happen. So if HaKadosh Baruch Hu will make a new creation in the world, and the earth will open its mouth and swallow them up and everything they have, Yadu Chayim Sha'ola, and they'll go down to the grave alive, then you'll know that these people have provoked Hashem. And the big question is, why was this manner of death singled out for Korach and his followers? Lots of ways that HaKadosh Baruch Hu could have killed them. There could have been a bolt of lightning from the heavens. They could have all just, dropped down dead, from simultaneous heart attacks, whatever it could have been. They could have drowned, I don't know what. Why particularly this type of punishment? So the Kli Yakar, in his commentary on the Chumash, addresses this, and he refers us to a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. There's a Mishnah in the third Perek of Pirkei Avot, which tells us, it's a well-known Mishnah, Havei mitpalel v'shlomah shel malchut, that a person should always daven for the welfare of the government in the place where they live. Why? She'il malei mora'a, were it not for fear of authority, ishet re'ehu chayim bla'o, everybody would swallow up everybody else. Meaning that, you know, you might not be a fan of Boris. You might not be a fan of Labour either. In Israel, you might not be a fan of Naftali Bennett or whoever is this week's prime minister there. Whatever it is, you know, you might not necessarily be a fan or agree with everything that the government does. But we need to appreciate that you need government. Because if it was a free-for-all for everybody, then it would be, you know, the biggest fish in the sea swallow up all the other ones. Anybody who's weak would be swallowed up by anybody who's stronger. It would be a free-for-all. But in any event, what the Mishnah is telling us is this notion of the strong swallowing up the weak. And that, says the Kli Yakar, was the symbolism of the earth opening up. Because what was Korach really asking for? Korach was asking for an unregulated society. He was saying that, you know, at least on the face of it, you know, behind the scenes we think that he was angling to become the leader himself, but the pshat of the psukim, the straightforward reading of the psukim, is quite simply that Korach didn't want any leadership. Ki chol haida kulam kadoshim. Everybody is equal. Everybody is equally holy, so nobody needs to be the leader. Therefore, he was told that the message was, without leadership, everybody gets swallowed up. There's no survival. You get swallowed up by whoever's stronger than you are. And that's why the earth opened up. The Ramban has an interesting discussion about this. He says, how can it be called a Bria Chadasha? This is a new phenomenon. He says, you have earthquakes all the time and, you know, cracks open in the ground. And, you know, whenever there's an enormous earthquake, you know, you find people, falling in and people getting sucked into sinkholes and all those sorts of things. What's the Chiddush here? The Ramban says the Chiddush is that usually when there's an earthquake or something like that, so the earth opens up, it doesn't close up again. That was the Chiddush here. The Chiddush here was that it was bala, it was like swallowing it. The earth opened and then closed its mouth again, and there was no escape at all. So that's what happened to Korach and his merry or unmerry band of followers. But very interestingly, in actual fact, that's not the end of the story, because what we find is that the people then complained and said, hold on a minute, you're now killing everybody. And they still needed some sort of sign that Moshe, what he was doing, it had veracity, and that it was correct and fair. So this is a big question in its own right. You know, how many signs did the people need? You know, there'd been the fire pans, where 250 people had been killed by the fire pans and the incense. Then Korach and his followers were swallowed up by the earth. And according to Chazal, you know, all their possessions, wherever they were, rolled down into the hole, and everything was swallowed up. And still, the people thought that, Moshe was up to trickery. They still didn't believe it, and they asked for a further sign. So, as we know, what was the further sign? The further sign was the rods. And all the Nasiim put their rods in front of the Aaron, and then it was Aaron's rods that flowered and produced shkedim, buds, and almonds, etc., etc. So a question that I would like to address on a future occasion is why were they not happy till now, and why was this a convincing argument against them? That, you know, why did this finally clinch the argument when nothing else did? But that's not what I'm going to address now. I'm just going to look at the final psukim there, at the beginning of Shishi, which is Perek Yud Zayin Pasuk Kaf Hei. So that's if we look on page the beginning of Shishi. Sorry, page 830. So after Aaron's staff has sprouted. Vayomer Adonai al Moshe, Hashem said to Moshe, Hashevet Matei Aaron ifnei Haidut, put the rod of Aaron in front of the Eidut, in front of the tablets of stone and the ark, the Mishmer ot livnei Meri, so it should be a safekeeping as a sign against rebellious people, or to chaltelu notam me alive lo yamutu, so their complaints will cease from me, and they won't die. Vayas Moshe kasher tivadunai oto keinasa, and Moshe did exactly as he was told to do. So an interesting question that I saw in the commentary on Znaim LaTorah, Rav Zalman Sorotskin's Sefer, he says, what was the point of putting the rods in front of the Aron? They were kept in the Kodesh HaKodashim, they were kept in the Holy of Holies. That was out of sight from everybody. If the purpose of these of retaining this was it should be an ot, it should be a sign, you put an ot where people can see it. There's no point putting an ot where nobody can access it, where nobody can see it. That's rather strange. So he says, and this is a notion we encounter very often in religious life, but he says that anything which you can see all the time, you become immune to it. You stop paying attention to it. So if there was a permanent sign up, that's warning people not to be rebellious, in actual fact, nobody would take any notice of it. Whereas, if it's kept in the Kodesh HaKodashim, but brought out on necessary occasions, so then it's effective. So really what it means is that whenever there was going to be a machloket, whenever the leaders sense there's a machloket, they would bring this out. But it's not. There's no point having it there on the wall all the time. Often you have things that, you can have, there are plaques up around the shul, hundreds of them, I could say to you, the plaque on, as you come into the main shul, on the right, what does it say? You'll all say to me, I've never noticed that plaque. Is there a plaque there? Never noticed it. Because it's there all the time. It's just like part of the furniture. So therefore, it's not helpful. You need sometimes you need important messages to be given on an occasional basis rather than on a permanent basis. Now, interestingly, the Machloket of Korach finds expression not only in this week's parsha, but it's a very famous Mishnah in Masechet Avot, in the fifth perek of Masechet Avot, which tells us that any machloket which is l'shem shamayim, sofalit kayem. If you have a machloket where it is all the parties have the right motivation, then ultimately it will be resolved. But if it's a machloket shelo l'shem shamayim, ein sofalit kayem. If it's not for the right motivation, then it's not going to be resolved. And then the Mishnah asks, what's an example of machloket l'shem shamayim? Machloket l'shem shamayim is machloket hilal v'shamay. What's the machloket shelo l'shem shamayim? Korach v'adato. So I saw a very nice vort on this notion of machloket hilal v'shamay to start with. Hilal v'shamay, throughout Shas we find Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. Why is it saying machloket l'shem shamayim is a machloket between Hillel and Shammai? So the suggestion is that in actual fact, Machloket Hillel and Shammai is definitely Shem Shammayim. Once the Talmidim get involved, you can't be so sure. A machloket between, this Rosh Yeshiva and that Rosh Yeshiva, or this chief rabbi and that chief rabbi, that's a machloket l'shem shamayim. But once the henchmen and the Talmidim get involved, my Rosh Yeshiva is greater than your Rosh Yeshiva. My rabbi is greater than your rabbi. They lose perspective, and it's not always l'shem shamayim. But a more fundamental question is, hold on, what's it saying? The machloket shelo l'shem shamayim is the machloket Korach v'Adator. In actual fact, the machloket shelo l'shem shamayim is the machloket between Korach and Moshe. That was, if we look in the Psukim, that was the machloket. Korach was arguing with Moshe. So I found two lovely answers to that question. One is from the Malbim. The Malbim says that when you've got the machloket shelo l'shem shamayim, you find that even the parties on the one side can't agree with each other. You look at Korach and his followers. They all had different goals. They weren't really in it, for each other. Korach was in it because he was upset that he wasn't a Kohen Gadol. The Reuvenites were in it because they were upset because, they were the firstborn, but Yehuda had taken the position of the firstborn, and Levi had taken the position of Kahuna. So, everybody had different motivations, and they weren't really at one. They joined teams to try and, resolve a particular issue, but there was constant interfighting amongst them. And that's why we talk about, if it's not Lashem Shamayim, then even Korach v'Adator, you're going to find in your own team, there's going to be dissent. I found in the Sefer Tosefet Bracha, which is an additional commentary by the Torah Tamima of Baruch HaLevi Epstein. He wrote a commentary on Chumash, the Torah Tamima, and then also another volume, the Tosefet Bracha. And he makes the observation that the reason why it doesn't say Korach v'Moshe is because if you look in the Pesuk, Moshe's not arguing with Korach. Korach was the one having the argument. My late father, Alav HaShalom, he always used when my brother and I were having a fight. As Barry will remember, my brother and I arguing on the way home from shul many times. One or other of us would come and complain to our parents. He's arguing with me. He's arguing. My father would always say, "It takes two to have a fight." And that's exactly what the Torah Tamima is saying as well. Takes two to have a fight. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't want to be part of the fight. And therefore, it was Korach v'Adator. It was really a one-sided machloket. Korach was shouting it himself. Moshe wasn't willing to get riled. I want to finish by going back to the very beginning of the parasha, referring to a medrash which is very, very well known, or at least I think it's well known. Rashi quotes it. The notion that what did Korach do when he came to Moshe Rabbeinu? He said, he engaged in imlomdus. And he said, "You know what? I've got a shaila for you. We're told you're supposed to wear tzitzit. And the tzitzit, the end of last week's parasha, says you have a p'til t'chelet, that you have white strings, but there should also be a blue string on it. So I've got a question. What if I've got talit shekula t'chelet? My whole talit is made out of t'chelet. Do I still need tzitzit on it with the blue strings? Or maybe I don't." And he said, "What if I've got, so there's a din that you need to have a mezuzah on a room. What if I've got a room which is full of Sifrei Torah? So do I still need the mezuzah on the door?" He says, it doesn't make any sense that if two paragraphs from the Torah on the door of the room should turn the room into being a holy room, that if I've got a room full of holiness, full of Sifrei Torah, it doesn't make any sense that I should need the mezuzah as well. So the question is, you know, what on earth was, you know, Korach talking about? You know, why bring these examples? So the Kli Yakar and others point out that, of course, these were illustrative of what he was trying to say. In terms of, what do you have with the tzitzit? Tzitzit, you have the beged, and what makes it good? You have something more important on it, the tzitzit on the corners. So you want to say that you've got the people, but there need to be leaders as well. I'm saying no. We're like Kichol Haidah Kulam Kadoshim. Everybody is holy. We're like the whole beged is techelet. We don't need leaders. So that's the imagery. Why he's giving these examples. I saw an explanation that really Korach's problem was that what he was suggesting was also a model of Avodat Hashem. Korach's model was, you know, it's all right to work in broad generalities. So long as you've got the right idea, you don't need to worry about the details. Now, what's the idea of the Tchelet in the Tzitzit? The Tchelet in the Tzitzit is to remind you of Hashem. The color blue reminds you of the sea, which reminds you of the sky, which reminds you of the Kisei HaKavod, etc., etc. So, you know, okay, the Torah says to use Tzitzit, but as long as I've got something blue, that's good enough. As the Torah tells me to put some mezuzah on my door. Why? Because I should have holiness, you know, words of holiness in my house. So I've got words of holiness in my house. I don't need to worry about the details. What Korach was saying was that, we can deal with broad strokes. We don't need a Judaism which is focused on the details. And Rav Soloveitchik describes Korach's rebellion. He describes it as being a common sense rebellion. That's what Korach was trying to say. Everything needs to be common sense. And then, you know, we don't need leaders. Why do we need, you know, why do I need a rabbi to tell me what to do? So, going back to my Watford days, I remember when I as part of the adult education program, I arranged for Rabbi Jeremy Conway to come to the shul and give a talk on kashrut and the kashrut department, etc. And the wife of one of the wardens objected to me. She said to me, "I've been keeping kosher all my life. I don't need a rabbi to come and tell me what to do." No, I'm not chas v'chalila comparing her to Korach in any sense at all. But that was her, you know, that's her. Oh, we don't need rabbis, we don't need experts. Everybody's an expert. We can, you know, it seems to me. That's, I often talk with my colleagues about, you know, the question that begins, you know, Rabbi, it seems to me. You don't need expertise in the realm. That's what Korach was saying. Korach was saying that the ikkah, the main focus of Judaism is the kiyum shebelev, the way you feel about it. You know, does this speak to you? So long as it speaks to you, then that's good enough. I think somebody's trying to, Mrs. Gadala's trying to get in there. So long as it speaks to you, that's good enough. You don't need to worry about the details. And that is exactly where he went wrong. You do need to worry about the details, and that's why you need manhigim, that's why you need leaders, that's why you needed Moshe and Aaron there to lead the people, to explain about the details, rather than it just being a free-from-all that everybody can make up their own ideas about, yeah, it seems to me this is a good enough way of doing it. So that's some thoughts about Parashat Korach. As I said, if you don't remember the Divrei Torah, you'll probably remember the joke. And as ever, always nice to have the opportunity to learn Torah with you. And I hope we'll get that chance sometime again in the future. So thank you all very much.